content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the New York Times and the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we begin our journey with writer Elaine Glusak. On a fall road trip in Alaska, prepare for the unexpected. Her story appeared in the October 15, 2021 issue of the New York Times. As the editor's subhead states, a five-day drive around the Kenai Peninsula reveals few crowds, affordable lodging, and autumn colors. But your ability to be flexible will almost certainly be tested. So let's begin and see what Elaine is going to teach us. The tap beer ran low, and boat tours were hit or miss, but the lines were rare, as were the bottlenecks on roads threading mountainsides where yellow poplars and aspens, ablaze in the cool fall temperatures, radiated among or amid the evergreens. This is fall in Alaska, perhaps the most fleeting of seasons, when the weather can swing wildly day by day from sunny, cloudless glory to 6 inches of wet snow. Alaskans have a love-hate relationship with fall because it is so fast, says Melissa Fry, the chief meteorologist with Alaska's news source. We see such a dramatic change from summer to winter, but it feels like it happens overnight. Summer, of course, is high season in the 49th state. When big ship cruising was suspended until July because of the pandemic, many travelers, inspired by the mandate for social distance and fresh air, turned to land travel in Alaska, which led to sellouts of rental cars and packed lodges. But by September, the masses had returned home, triggering shoulder season, a time of sparse crowds, available cars, and reasonable lodging rates, enticements that attracted my son, who had just concluded a season working for the Forest Service in Alaska, and let me take a five-day drive around the Kenai Peninsula south of Anchorage. Compared to a trip to Alaska that I'd made in July, shoulder season was a bargain and offered a chance to see it in a different light, which, by the way, lasted about 12 hours a day in late September. But as with so many other things about the state, Alaska, we discovered, is different by the fall or in the fall, when many tourism businesses close and changeable weather demands you loosen your grip on firm plans. Driving the Kenai Peninsula. Testing our flexibility from the start, the Kenai trip came about after the road into Denali National Park abruptly closed about halfway into its 92-mile length in late August because of a landslide. Slides have been occurring in the park's Pretty Rocks area since at least the 1960s, but the impact of climate change, specifically warmer winters and increased precipitation, causing the frozen ground to thaw, took what was once addressed by periodic road repairs to a challenge too difficult to overcome with short-term solutions, according to the National Park Service in a news release announcing the closure. Instead of driving north from Anchorage, we decided to head south to the Kenai Peninsula, which extends about 150 miles southwest of the Chugach Mountains near Anchorage, pinched by the Cook Inlet to the west and Prince William Sound to the east. We paid $376 for a rental SUV from Avis, Alaska, for the entire trip, but compact cars for the same period started around $210. They call it Alaska's playground because Alaskans all go there, too. Rachinda Sandlin-Timmits, the marketing and content manager for Alaska Tour and Travel, an agency in Anchorage, told me the week before the trip. It's just really beautiful country, and with mountains, forests, big rivers, important for salmon, and the coast with beautiful fjords and glaciers, all in a relatively small area by Alaska standards. Stopping just short of the peninsula on our first night in the town of Gurwood, about 40 miles from the Anchorage Airport, we checked into the Ski Inn at $199 a night, a cozy 8-room lodge in the downtown area, less than a mile from the looming Mount Alyeska, home to Alaska's most popular ski resort. At the fire pits outside Gurwood Brewing Company, we drank IPAs with three kayaking guides who were road tripping around the state after finishing their summer working in Seward, which they described as off-the-charts busy. The temperature was sinking into the 50s by the time we were seated on the porch at Spoonline Bistro for seared Kodiak Island scallop starting at $20 and glazed duck breast that starts at $38, but servers helpfully positioned two strong space heaters beside us. Glaciers by land. It didn't take long to learn that the best laid plans in Alaska require a plan B. In Gurwood, we awoke to the news that high winds had triggered a marine warning, and our six-hour cruise with the Kenai Fords tours to Kenai Fords National Park at $153 a person from the gateway town of Seward had been canceled. After a stop at the Forest Service Visitor Center in Gurwood, which offers maps of much of the peninsula, we settled on Whittier, a port on Prince William Sound, nearly 25 miles from Gurwood, and its Portage Glacier as our substitute destination. Generally speaking, road tripping in Alaska, a state bigger than California, Texas, and Montana combined, is time-consuming. Towns that look like neighbors on the map can be distant. Frequent scenic pullouts, two-lane roads, and moose crossing warnings discourage speeding. Even by Alaska standards, reaching Whittier is a uniquely protracted undertaking, requiring motorists to take a 2.5-mile toll tunnel, $13 round trip by car, that is only wide enough for one-way traffic, which switches directions on the half hour. You don't have to wait for the tunnel to glimpse the Portage Glacier, which once filled the 14-mile valley that connects the Kenai to mainland Alaska, but the hike on the other side more than justified the wait. After a fairly vertical mile up, we reached a viewpoint across a grassy valley to the mountain funnel cradling the glacier, which terminated in serrations of pale blue ice poised to spill into Portage Lake. While we found viewing oceanfront glaciers by tour boat was unreliable in the fall, mountain and valley glaciers like Portage offered rewards well earned by hiking. Near Seward, about 90 miles down the road from Whittier, a series of trails, including a mile-long paved loop, offered relatively easy access to Snaking Exit Glacier, the only part of Kenai Fjords National Park accessible by land. End of the season. At Resurrection Roadhouse, a sprawling restaurant on the road to Exit Glacier, the bartender pointed us to a chalkboard beer list and handed over a note listing about half of the brews that were unavailable. "We close in 4 days," she explained. Travelers could still get a porter, but not a blonde ale. Nachos were available, but jalapenos weren't. Complaints were few, however, as local patrons celebrated the end of a long season. "This is our favorite part of the year," said Ian Whittle, who drives a tour boat in Seward, having dinner at the bar next to us. "We never get to do anything in season," added his companions, Tamara Lang, who also works on day cruises. In downtown Seward, a town of about 3,000 residents, shops with signs saying "See you in 2022 were posted alongside Go Lydia banners for the local Olympic swimmer Lydia Jacoby, who won gold and silver medals at the Tokyo Olympics. Through Airbnb, we reserved a cheerful studio apartment with mountain views above a closed coffee shop downtown, starting at $139, but the host helpfully supplied us with a good whole bean coffee. Fortunately, Seward's chief indoor attraction, the Alaska Sea Life Center, remains open throughout the year, offering opportunities to explore Alaska's rich marine ecosystem, otherwise unnavigable in season. Here, tanks expose that beneath the whitecaps outside, from 800-pound stellar sea lions and diving puffins to salmon fry, wolf eel, spot prawn, and gumboat kitson. We had the touch tanks to ourselves to observe the long and gradual process of sea stars and sea urchins moving the fragments of squid patiently fed by their keepers toward their mouths. End of the road. The weather roulette spun overnight, landing on a bright, clear, and windless morning in Seward, ideal conditions for a four-mile hike on Tunsina Creek Trail, just south of town. The trail roughly parallels the ocean bluffs through a mossy spruce and hemlock forest to the banks of the eponymous creek, where salmon carcasses left by foraging bears littered the banks at low tide. Although the afternoon Kenai Fjord boat tours were back on, we had to press on with 3.5-hour drive ahead of us to Homer. Homer lies at the end of Route 1, or the Sterling Highway, which curls around the western side of the peninsula, lingering along the banks of milky Kenai Lake, then following the churning Kenai River, where anglers waded gamely with the rapids. On the bright, clear day, we pulled over every possible chance to snap saturated shots of flaming fall leaves against backdrops of newly snow-dusted peaks. Among more substantive stops, the Kenai River Brewing Company in Saldonta, about 75 miles shy of Homer, served two-fisted black bean burgers at $14 on a heated patio facing a forest. After another 40 miles, we reached coastal Ninacek, home to a hilltop Russian Orthodox church dating back to 1901, a modest frame outpost facing 10,000-foot mountains in Lake Clark National Park and Preserve across the Cook Inlet. Over its last few miles, the Sterling bends dramatically eastward, revealing a blufftop view that compels motorists to pause. Ketchumick Bay, and on its far shore, Ketchumick Bay State Park, where glaciers pooled around jagged peaks. We soon found we had this same view from our furnished yurt on a secluded hillside property with a fire ring and a modern bathroom in a neighboring tiny house that cost us $174 a day. In the trade-off calculation that is fall travel in Alaska, we came out ahead, believing, as Airbnb assured us, that the yurt was a rare find and usually booked. On the calm and mild afternoon we arrived, the Homer Spit, a roughly 4.5-mile-long lowland slicing into Ketchumick Bay from mainland Homer, was bustling with shoppers strolling the stilted sidewalks. Water taxis dropped and retrieved travelers at the remote state park. Back on shore, we visited the farmer's market for picnic supplies, stocking up on the outsized carrots and cauliflower that distinguish Alaskan vegetables planted during summer's extended daylight conditions. But on the next overcast and blustery morning, the Spit was deserted, and the water taxi we booked canceled. As Plan B, the dispatcher recommended heading a few miles north of town to hike the Diamond Creek Trail, a short but steep switchback route to a black sand beach where we wandered between boulders revealed at low tide, counting the anemones and crabs left in their tide pools. Several of the most popular restaurants in Homer were closed, making us enthusiastic regulars of Fat Olives, that's dishing pieces with yeasty, bubbling crust, some of the best pies I've had in the lower 48, and they started about $15. Late on our last afternoon, as snowflakes started to fly, four sandhill cranes glided into the wetlands beside the Spit. Resting before heading south, they gave us rare, up-close looks of the red markings on their heads and the rust-colored grasses surrounding, reminding us that there is no bad weather or bad season in Alaska, just bad gear. So there you go. Make sure you check your gear if you're headed for Alaska, right? I guess that's the point. Well, Associated Press writer Patrick Quiddle has been taking a close look at fall color. Now, his story, A Forgotten Fall, Climate Change Makes It Harder to Chase Fall Foliage, appeared in the October 1st weekend extra edition of The News and Observer. Dateline is Portland, Maine. Droughts that cause leaves to turn brown and wither before they can reach peak color. Heat waves prompting leaves to fall before the autumn even arrives. Extreme weather events like hurricanes that strip trees of their leaves altogether. For a cheery autumnal activity, leaf peeping is facing some serious threats from the era of climate change. Leaf peeping, the practice of traveling to watch nature display its fall colors, is a beloved annual activity in many corners of the country, especially New England and New York. But recent seasons have been disrupted by weather conditions there and elsewhere, and the trend is likely to continue as the planet warms, said arborist, conservationist, and ecologist. Typically, by the end of September, leaves cascade into warmer hues throughout the U.S. This year, many areas have yet to even pivot from their summer green shades. In northern Maine, where peak conditions typically arrive in late September, forest rangers had reported less than 70% color change and moderate leaf drop on Wednesday. That was September 29th. Across the country in Denver, high temperatures have left dead, dry leaves or edges of leaves early in the season, said Michael Sundberg, a certified arborist in the area. Instead of trees doing this gradual change, they get thrown these wacky weather events. They change all of a sudden, or they drop leaves early, Sundberg said. It's been a few years since we've really had good leaf year, where you just drive around and see the really good color. The reason climate change can be bad for fall foliage has a bit to do with the plant biology. When fall arrives and day length and temperature drop, the chlorophyll in a leaf breaks down, and that causes it to lose its green color. The green gives way to the yellows, reds, and oranges that make for dramatic autumn displays. Achieving those peak colors is a delicate balance, and one jeopardized by changes in the environment, said Paul Schaeberg, a research plant physiologist with the U.S. Forest Service based in Burlington, Vermont. Warm fall temperatures can cause leaves to remain green longer and delay the onset of what leaf peepers look for in terms of fall color, he said. Worse, dry summers can stress trees and cause their leaves to miss the fall color turn altogether, Schaeberg said. A 2003 study in the journal Tree Physiology that Schaeberg co-wrote stated that environmental stress can accelerate leaf deterioration. If climate change is going to mean significant drought, that means trees are going to shut down, and many trees are just going to drop their leaves, he said. Severe droughts that really mean that the tree just can't function, and that doesn't improve color. Well, it's happening already. This summer's heat wave in the Pacific Northwest brought temperatures of over 110 degrees Fahrenheit or 43 degrees Celsius to Oregon. And that led to a condition called foliage scorch, in which leaves prematurely brown, said Chris Still, a professor at the Forest Ecosystems and Society Department at Oregon State University. The leaves' pigment was degraded, and they fell shortly thereafter, Still said. That will lead us to a less scenic fall season in parts of Oregon. That's a really big example of color change just due to a heat wave shock, Still said. Climate change also poses longer-term threats that could disrupt leaf peeping. The spread of diseases and invasive pests and the northward creep of tree species are all factors tied to warming temperatures that could make for less vibrant fall colors, said Andrew Richardson, a professor of ecosystem science at Northern Arizona University. The onset of fall colors, which has been drifting later into the fall, could also continue to arrive later, said Jim Salge, foliage expert for Yankee Magazine. My observation in the last decade have been more than years that were better that we would consider historical averages, he said. The economic impact of poor leaf peeping season could also be consequential. Officials throughout New England have said fall tourism brings billions of dollars into those states every year. Conservationists say that's a good reason to focus on preserving forest and reducing burning fossil fuels. Recent fall seasons have been less spectacular than typical in Massachusetts, but leaf peeping can stay a part of the state's heritage if forests are given the protections they need, said Andy Fenton, landscape conservation director and forest ecologist for the Nature Conservancy. If we can keep the big, important forest intact, they will provide what we've depended on, clean air, clean water, clean forest, as well as fall inspiration, Fenton said. Well, while some of us may enjoy traveling to see fall color, writer Mackenzie Whittle of Bend, Oregon, has discovered geocaching. Now, this is treasure hunting for the 21st century. Her story was written for her hometown paper, The Bulletin, and was republished in the October 19, 2021 issue of the News and Observer. Despite having tried most outdoor activities, I'd never attempted the high-tech treasure hunt of geocaching, though I would stumble across caches all the time while out and about. I was ripe to give it a try. Thinking there would only be a few to hunt down around Bend, I made an account on geocaching.com and took a look, and that is spelled G-E-O-C-A-C-H-I-N-G, geocaching.com, if you'd like to check it out. She goes on to say, I was stunned when I saw well over hundreds of colorful dots overlaid on a map of the area, including one deep red dot indicating an upcoming GeoTour launch event. Now, beginning this past Saturday, which would have been October 16th, eager newbies and seasoned cachers alike can take in some of the great sights we have in Central Oregon by joining the Bend Arts, Culture, and Adventure Geo Tour, sponsored by the Bulletin and the EO Media Group. Saturday's event afforded locals and visitors alike a fun chance to get to know the area a little more and visit some Bend businesses for bonus points. For those of you who still don't know quite what geocaching is, or who think it's a thing that was all the rage in the mid-aughts, but has failed, or since faded, rather, now is a great time to check it out. So here we go with what is geocaching. The actual act of geocaching is relatively simple. Someone hides a container with a logbook or trinkets and marks the location of it with their GPS. Then someone else finds said container by following the coordinates and any clues the hider had left. In 2000, GPS technology was still on the rise, and enthusiasts were populating early internet message boards and email chains. On May 2nd of that year, Great Blue Switch that controlled selective availability was flipped, meaning that GPS became more responsive to civil and commercial users worldwide. That's according to GPS.gov. For those enthusiasts, more accuracy meant a lot, and one GPS user decided to test it out the next day. Dave Ulmer of Beaver Creek hit a navigational target in the woods, according to geocaching.com, and put the coordinates online, calling it the Great American GPS Stash Hunt. Ulmer filled a black bucket with a logbook and some prizes, including some videos, books, software, and a slingshot, with the intent that whoever found the stash would take something and leave something behind for the next person. 3 days later, two people found the bucket and posted about it, confirming the accuracy of their system, and geocaching was born. Nowadays, there are different types of geocaches that have evolved from the initial one, including but not limited to letterboxes, just a logbook, mystery, the location is not the cache but has a puzzle or clue to solve in order to find the cache elsewhere. Multi-caches, the initial point has hints to other caches in the area, not on the map, and traditional take-a-prize, leave-a-prize caches. Try it yourself. Picking up geocaching really doesn't take anything but an app download, your phone, and zeal for the hunt. Geocaching.com seems to be the most complete and user-friendly website to grab information on nearby and far-flung caches, and you can make an account for free. Some options require premium paid subscriptions. When I logged in for the first time, I was struck by not only the large number of caches in the Bend area, but also the creative way in which geocachers have distributed their caches. Some caches are in a series plotted in designs like hearts or letters. Others are longer, much longer. Along the George Milliken Road are over 206 caches on the east side of the road from Milliken to Prineville. The user, Global Trekker and Putter, states in their description the challenge of how many can you do in a day. For me, it was only two. I don't believe I've ever driven George Milliken Road before, maybe a part of it, but for me it was always just a dry, dusty turnoff on the way from Bend to Bern that I would always marvel at, because if you took it, you somehow end up in Prineville. But the drive along the sleepy stretch of High Desert Road offered some great views and fun hunting for caches along the way, and that seems to be part of the allure of this hobby, seeing the sights in addition to feeling like a pirate searching for buried treasure. I don't want to spoil the hunt anymore by revealing too many hints for geocaches I found, but not all of them are easy. With my trusty iPhone in hand, I was led directly to some, while others eluded me completely, even though I was supposedly on top of them. For the ones I did find, though, there was a certain endorphin rush that added to the enjoyment of the day. Wherever the road, trail, or geocache takes you, knowing you found the treasure on the map is an added little bonus to a day of adventuring. Sounds like fun. Well, travel writer Ann Cameron has discovered a place where residents are sharing the suburbs with beavers. She calls them nature's engineers. Initially written as a special to the Washington Post, Ann's story was republished in the October 15, 2021 extra edition of the News and Observer. Throughout the country, suburban areas such as Greenbelt, Maryland, and Arlington, Virginia, have wetlands, lakes, and streams that were created or reshaped by large brown, flat-tailed, orange-toothed rodents. Beavers, like humans, change their surroundings to fit their needs. Known as nature's engineers, they topple trees to build lodges to live in and dams to raise water levels for protection from predators. Dams also slow water's flow while filtering sediment and pollutants that would otherwise flow downstream. The resulting wetlands often attract wildlife diversity where none had existed. There are challenges, though. Beaver dams sometimes cause flooding, and most people prefer trees alive and upright. Communities face a delicate balancing act, learning to coexist with beavers. In late 2019, many people enjoying Washington and Old Dominion, also called WNOD Trail near Glen Carlin Park in Arlington, became beaver fans as one furry family transformed Sparrow Road, a sediment-filled man-made stormwater management area, into an oasis for muskrats, birds, frogs, turtles, and deer. Yet such activity caused concern. As beavers worked, they raised water levels about 5 feet. The increased depth allows beavers to survive underwater if the pond ices over in winter. But county officials were concerned about how higher water would affect the steep soil bank supporting the paved hike and bike trail. As a local government, it's our job to find a good balance between protecting the WNOD trail and the beavers, said Lily Weitzel of the county's Environmental Services Department. In April, the county installed a beaver baffle, that's a pond leveler. Beavers often rush to plug leaks in their dams. Baffles stabilize water levels by creating a hidden exit for high water to escape through the dam unnoticed by the beavers. Beavers inhabit Greenbelt's Buddy Attic Lake Park. Visitors love seeing them, but also love the park's mature trees. Recently, Eagle Scout Andrew Jones, 18, organized a tree caging event, putting wire mesh around the large tree trunks to protect them while conserving beaver habitats. About 20 volunteers cage 60 trees to discourage beavers from gnawing them and overeating. It also protects people from injury due to random trees falling, he said. We cover the trees we don't want them to eat while providing others they like, said Louisa Robles, Greenbelt sustainability specialist. Some new trees are periodically planted just for the beavers. We need to learn to yield a little of our wants to share the earth's resources, she said. When water levels or food sources decrease, beavers move on. At Sparrow Pond, summer rains cause more sediment to flow in, while the baffle prevented water from rising. Beavers weren't seen for weeks. Sophia Kahn, 8, whose family periodically visits the pond to watch wildlife, said, "If the beavers are gone, I'll be really sad." Heavy rains in late September brought good news for Sophia. A beaver return, doing what beavers do, checking out the dam for any needed repairs. Now, Sparrow Pond's restoration project for 2023 will improve sediment management, restore proper water depth, and improve wildlife habitat without creating problems for the trail. A beaver baffle will also be included so beaver families can make the pond their home in the future, noted the project's flyer. The balancing act continues. My, what a great story that was, wasn't it? And reminds me, not too long ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, in a lake near my home here in North Raleigh, we discovered there were beavers falling trees along the edge of a golf course, and they were building dams, and that created a little bit of a problem in trying to get the lake level at the proper balance on the course. So they had to trap the beavers and relocate them. Fortunately, they didn't harm them. They just put them in another area. But I know exactly the kind of work these rascals can do. It was always fascinating to hike in that area and see what they had left, how they felled certain trees and then used them to build their little dens and their little dams where they lived. So amazing creatures indeed. So if you ever have a chance, it's worth the hike, okay? Well, my friends, that's going to do it for today's Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and that you'll be with us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any questions or comments, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.